things get a little bit grim.
But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah!
That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
But you did, in fact, survive.
Yes, I did. I did.
It was a good party, though.
It was so fun. It was so fun. You did such a good job.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad it worked out the way it did. I'm still a little salty about
the Black Forest.
The Black Forest, but it's fine.
It's okay.
Well, but we made it through. We're definitely not in our 20s anymore to where we cannot party like we used to.
No. I gave myself like a hard 3-shot of Fireball rule.
Yeah.
And that went out the window.
How many do you think you did?
Do I think I did?
Yeah.
Or do I know?
Do you know?
I know I did 5.
Okay. How many could have been happening?
I think if we're looking more at like an 8.
Woof.
Woof. Woof. But Fireball just doesn't hit me hard. You know what I mean? It's a very mellow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did a shot of Fireball. Not at your party. At the bar the other night.
Yeah.
And it got me real.
Did it?
Real hard. Oh. I was like, uh-oh.
Fireball does it for me.
Oh!
It's the only thing I can shoot anymore. I can't do tequila.
Yeah, we did a green tea shot, too.
But what's in that?
I don't know. Something lemony.
Okay.
But the bartender didn't know how to make it.
Oh.
So my friend was like, telling him how to make it.
Yeah.
And he, like, did a trial run for us.
Okay.
So he didn't charge us for it.
Okay.
It was a little too lemony, but otherwise it was good.
Like a lemon drop?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, we did that. And then I ordered a beer at the next bar, and then I ordered a White Claw, and by the time my White Claw came, I was like, I cannot drink this.
No.
So I left
a White Claw in vain.
I left an entire White Claw on the bar.
That's growth. We would have never allowed that back in our
younger days. No, I was like, I made an error in this order, and I need nothing but a sparkling water. At this point,
I would just settle for like a regular water.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So that was the last time I've done shots. I did not do shots at your bachelorette party.
Good. That's for the best.
Yeah. I had one drink at the bar we went to, and oh my gosh, it was strong.
I was like, did you have vodka soda?
Yeah.
It was like the world's biggest.
It was the world's biggest. It was the world's strongest. Not convinced there was soda.
Uh-huh. Vodka and ice.
Yeah.
Vodka neat.
Yeah.
On rocks, I think. Yeah, knee is.
Something like that.
Knee is with nothing.
So Jenny and I are battling hangovers on day 2 after a party.
Uh-huh.
So
We'll keep you updated in the future.
Yeah.
About how it goes.
So anyway, what a disaster.
That was a good one.
Thanks.
Listen, I've had a lot more disastrous nights. Nobody broke a bone.
That's so true.
Only one person threw up, and it wasn't me.
Everybody got home safe.
Everybody got home safe. It was a blast.
It was so fun. Really, really glad that it ended up going well.
Yes.
Did you just text me, can I break in?
Yeah. I texted you when I was downstairs.
It's not breaking in. You have the code.
Yeah, but I just, okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Sorry. Oh, I have to close my email. My wedding coordinator just emailed me. I don't want to look at that right now.
We will come back around to that at a later date.
I promise I will circle back to you, Patrice. Okay. Disaster. Who's first?
Girl, I don't have any idea.
Rock, paper, scissors.
All right, ready?
It's been a long time.
Yeah. Who goes for what? Who wins? Who gets what when we win?
Whoever wins goes first.
Okay. Ready? Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
All right.
All right. Here we go.
Taylor's up.
I gotta load it on up.
She
here.
Hit me with the scissors.
Yeah, just a recap of what happened in our audio podcast.
Because you can't see.
Oh, Lord. I have a good one.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
I have a good one, too.
I'm really excited about it.
Okay, go on.
All right. So, Let's see if the whole thing loads before I get too into my story and then have to
false alarm.
Make sure. Okay, yeah, looks good. Looks great. Okay, so my sources are an article called The Blast from the Past by Robert Evans, a YouTube video by Horror Stories Channel, another YouTube video by Geographics Channel, and an article by Lloyd Alter. This is a shitstorm.
Okay.
Of a disaster.
Okay.
The disaster itself was really, really bad, but what happened after is what really propelled this event into the history books.
Okay.
I present to you today, for your enjoyment, a BOGO disaster. I have a buy one, get one.
Ooh.
A twofer.
I love a clearance sale.
Right. I mean, she was yellow tag.
Wow. Da-da-da-da. Sale.
All right. A volcano in Sumbawa, now Indonesia, had been a pretty sleepy mountain for the last several decades before 1815.
Sleepy boy tucked in, yeah, taking a snooze.
Just a little snooze. I mean, it was a long snooze. He'd been quiet for quite a while. Nobody even really knew that he was a volcano.
Oh, really?
Everybody just thought he was a mountain.
A little rock.
No. No, no, no. My sweet baby angels.
Fucking volcano in disguise.
Yeah.
He said, surprise, shawty.
Gotcha, bitches. All right. So there is a chance that they thought it was just a regular old mountain. In 1812, the volcano coughed a little. It generated a little dark cloud. And people thought, that's weird. Carry on.
Our mountain has a cold.
Yeah. Keep going.
About your business, everyone.
Yep. So for the next 3 years or so, Mount Tambora would occasionally spout out a dark cloud or would rumble, but it was just something that people got used to. And then they went along with their daily business.
Did we not have an Indiana Jones out there on scene?
Apparently not.
Okay.
However, in 1815, Mount Tambora yawned, stretched its legs, and roared.
Uh-oh.
On the morning of April 5th, volcanic ash started falling in East Java with a faint detonation sounds lasting until April 10th.
What?
So 5 days of just
grumble?
Yeah.
My stomach after fireball.
What was first thought to be the sound of firing guns was heard on April 5th in Sumatra, more than 2,600 kilometers or 1,600 miles away.
Whoa.
They heard what they thought was gunshots. No, this just the mountain.
What?
Yeah. Military leaders even deployed soldiers thinking that they were under attack.
You're going to need better soldiers.
You do not have enough defenses for this.
No.
The British governor of Java, Sir Thomas Stamford Bingley Raffles, quite the name.
Is he a fucking clown?
I know. I really did think that. Wrote about his observations of the native people in his 1817 book called History of Java. And we lean on this writing to tell us pieces of what happened during the eruption, as this was before the telegraph and word was slow to travel across the globe.
Ooh.
He wrote about the initial sounds in his book and he said, "The first explosions we heard on this island of the evening of 5th of April, they were noticed in every quarter and continued at intervals until the following day. The noise was in the first instance almost universally attributed to distant cannon, so much so that a detachment of troops were marched from a nearby province in the expectation that a neighboring post was attacked, and along the coast, boats were in two instances dispatched in quest of a supposed ship in distress."
No, you better get them out of the water.
Yep. On the morning of April 10th, the explosions intensified. Three plumes rose up and emerged. The whole mountain was turned into a flowing mass of liquid fire. Pumice stones.
Ooh.
Of 8 inches in diameter.
Oh my.
Fell from the sky.
Oh my.
In burning heaps.
Jesus.
I know. Pyroclastic flows cascaded down the mountain to the sea on all sides of the peninsula, wiping out the village of Tambora. Loud explosions were heard until the next morning, April 11th. The ash veil spread as far as West Java and South Sulawesi. I'm not sure. A nitrous odor was noticeable in Batavia, and heavy tephra-tinged rain fell, finally receding between April 11th and April 17th.
Rain?
Rain.
Heavy, what kind of rain?
Tephra tinged rain.
What is tephra?
It's like the stuff inside the mountain, like the ash and stuff.
Ooh.
Yeah. So it all mixed it with the rain.
Black rain?
It went into the clouds.
Ah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Bad news.
Okay.
It just gets worse.
Chocolate rain.
Oh my god. Not.
Sorry.
Forbidden rain.
Good soup. Good soup.
Forbidden rain. All right. VEI is the Volcanic Explosivity Index and is similar to the Tornado Index.
Okay.
It's on the scale from 0 to 8, and we have not seen a level 8 in any modern times recorded history.
Really?
Right. Mount Vesuvius was a level 5.
What?
Yeah. Mount Pelee, the volcano I covered in episode 49, was a level 4.
Oh, dang.
In each level, the badness ups times 10. So
that's quite a grading curve.
Right? So a level 5 is 10 times worse than a level 4.
Holy shit. Well.
Talk about escalating quickly.
No kidding. That was only 4?
Yeah.
That's halfway?
Yeah. So.
Girlfriend.
Mount Tambora is considered a level 7. It was fucking bad. Bad. This volcano.
Roasty toasty.
Just.
Unleashed hell. You're dead.
Onto the entire earth.
Holy God. Okay.
So it is estimated that the explosion blew 12 cubic miles of gas, rock, and pyroclastic material into the air.
What do you mean 12 miles?
12 cubic miles.
My brain can't.
Of shit in the air.
Make it.
I can't. I can't. I don't know.
Too large to compute.
Yes.
Okay.
Too much. Brain shuts down. Cannot understand.
How big is a cubic mile?
Like. I don't know.
Well,
it's a mile, but squared. Right? No.
Cute.
Taylor, don't. Don't do it. Please stop.
Okay, move on. Get us caught in this.
I went to college, I swear to God. The pyroclastic material weighed about 8 billion tons. No, I'm sorry, 10 billion tons. 10 billion with a B. Tons.
Ooh, that's all gonna come crashing down.
Mm-hmm. The whole friggin' top of the mountain was gone.
Jesus.
It was left at about 2/3 of its original height. The crater on the top of the volcano was just over 4 miles across.
Damn, that's a big hole.
It left a friggin' just a gaping hole. So this was the largest volcanic eruption in recorded history.
Believe that.
Yeah. There has not been one worse. And there was not one worse before recorded times.
Okay.
It is estimated that the island's 10,000 inhabitants died instantly, and the volcano continued to spew out gas and ash until July of that year.
You are lying!
I would never lie to you about volcanic ash, Jenny!
Of all the things I lie about, volcanic ash is not one of them! I cannot. How long is that? That's like 3 months?
Yeah.
Hope.
Yeah.
Bro.
Just continuing to go.
People who don't talk about their feelings.
Yeah. People who go to therapy after 45 years.
Yes.
It's a volcano. Mount Tambora. Okay. So. Okay. So we get like this constant ash and stuff for 3 months, right?
Okay. Perfect. Love that for the atmosphere.
Random flames and rumbling and aftershocks would take place for the next 3 years.
What do you? Random flames?
Just like flames.
Like a blowtorch?
Yeah. I hope. I don't know.
Yo.
I hope that's what it sounds like.
Can we take like a glacier and drop it down? Like just a hunk of a glacier and drop it down a volcano, cool things down?
I mean, maybe, but we don't need help getting rid of our glaciers.
I mean, that's true. That's let's keep them where they're at.
Yeah. Unfortunately, not only did pretty much everyone in the immediate vicinity perish when Tambora exploded, the effects of the blast would affect humanity on a global scale. In fact, we are still finding repercussions of the explosion today.
We are?
Yeah.
Such as?
Well, I'll tell you about it.
Okay, sorry. Right. I'm so intrigued.
So according to Robert McNamara's article on ThoughtCo.com, a local ruler, the Raja of Saugur, gave his account of the cataclysm to British officer Lieutenant Owen Phillips. He described three columns of flames rising from the mountain when it erupted on April 10th. Apparently describing the lava flow, the Raja said that the mountain appeared to appear like a body of liquid fire extending itself in every direction. The Raja also described the effect of the wind unleashed by the eruption. Between 9 and 10 p.m., ashes began to fall, and soon after, a violent whirlwind ensued, which blew down nearly every house in the village of Saugur, carrying the tops and light parts along with it.
Oh, what?
In the part of Saugur, S-A-U-G-A-R. Saugur?
Saugur.
Okay. Adjoining Mount Tambora, its effects were much more violent, tearing up by the roots the largest trees and carrying them into the air together with men, houses, cattle, and whatever else came within its influence.
Oh my God.
Yeah. This will account for the immense number of floating trees seen at sea. The sea rose nearly 12 feet higher than it had ever been before and completely spoiled the only small spots of rice lands in Saugur, seeping away houses and everything within its reach.
What?
Yeah.
Because of how much rock was tossed in it? What happened to the ocean?
So, it also caused tsunamis.
Oh, sure.
So, I'm assuming that when all of this happened, it affected
everything
else.
Yeah, okay.
On the face of the planet.
Is this the worst snowball ever?
It's just so bad. So, the force of the explosion uprooted all these trees on the island, and the trees mixed with pumice stone and lava, and they all floated into the ocean.
What?
And created huge rafts that spanned 3 miles long.
What?
Just pumice and trees.
Of just volcano trash.
Yeah, in the ocean.
Wow.
Floating around.
Wow.
Keeping boats from doing their shit.
And you just want us to pick up your mess.
Yeah.
Because you had a temper tantrum.
Yeah.
Great.
Pick this up yourself.
Right.
And if you can't calm down, I will call your father.
Zeus!
Zeus! okay, so in October of 1815, two English ships ran into these rafts almost 2,200 miles from Tambora, and the ships were forced to go around the rafts.
What?
Can you imagine just being like, the fuck is this?
There's a hunk of land here.
This is a floating island where nothing can live.
Just dead trees and rock.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Obviously, all the vegetation on the island was destroyed, and everyone left who depended on the crops from this area faced starvation.
Ooh.
The eruption caused tsunamis that would strike the shores of various islands in the Indonesian
archipelago.
That's it. Mm-hmm. On April 10th. The total death toll has been estimated to be around 4,600 from just the tsunamis. It is estimated that 90,000 more people died in the immediate after effects of the eruption, but the death toll would continue to climb for weeks and months to come. Because Tambora barfed so much shit into the air, it had to go somewhere. So the blanket of gas dust and debris that went into the air got stuck in the atmosphere, and as the earth moved, it spread over the whole northern hemisphere.
Ooh, uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. Spaghetti, yes.
The next year after the explosion would become to be known as the Year Without a Summer.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Longitudinal winds spread the fine particles around the globe, creating an optical phenomenon. The global temperature dropped about 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah. And those who follow, like, global warming now... All the global warming activists are losing their shit about 3 degrees.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Europe, China, India, and North America were affected the most drastically. It was so cold in parts of the world that snow fell and rivers froze in the middle of summer. Not to mention how horribly the crops failed that year, resulting in a famine. It is also estimated that up to 1 million people died of famine or disease from the lack of crops.
Oh, my God.
It's just awful.
The whole, nobody made it out.
No.
Unscathed.
Right. Yeah. The entire planet was affected.
But imagine, like, the people who are on the other side of the world.
Like, what is happening?
Oh, right. They're like making, sacrificing goats to the old gods, and
I'm about to get into all of it.
Oh, okay, okay, awesome.
Okay. So just because I said nearly everything in a 20-mile radius died instantly doesn't mean that everything, in fact, did die. Because, of course, we've got microbes and pestilence.
Don't forget about the pestilence
Don't
now.
Don't forget. The nearby islands faced dysentery during the spring and summer of 1815. Another shit-ton of people died trying to fight off the disease. People were desperate to escape their fate and sold everything that they had in order to afford to immigrate to a new area. Unfortunately, some people even sold their children into slavery to afford a ticket.
Yikes.
Yeah, real bad. The sulfur in the atmosphere was wreaking havoc on the planet. In Ireland, in 1816, they had 8 straight weeks of rain that killed all their crops.
What?
England's growing season was almost non-existent. Everyone kept hoping that the weather would clear up and things would get better, but soon they realized they were in for an even worse time than they thought. In June, a frost settled over Central Europe and destroyed the remaining food supply. In Italy, orange snow fell from the sky in the middle of summer.
Orange?
Orange.
Why was it orange?
It's that tempera.
Oh, God.
That's making everything orange.
Oh. Oh my God.
Yep.
Okay.
One silver lining, I guess, you could say, is that the orange sulfur in the sky made really beautiful sunsets. However,
Not worth it.
Not worth it. The crop failures caused the price of bread to double. Due to the rising prices of food, people started rioting and looting.
Uh-oh.
The papers called this event God's wrath, which caused church attendance to spike.
Great.
Yep.
Love that.
Because of the lack of crops and the lack of clean water, typhus epidemic struck many parts of Ireland and Central Europe. The famine of 1816 was horrendous and countless people died. While Italy was also plagued by famine, it was also plagued with panic-stricken citizens. An anonymous astronomer had predicted that sunspots would overwhelm the sun and cause darkness by July 18th, 1816. Oh. So when the sun seemingly did not come out during the spring and summer, people were losing their shit.
He got so lucky.
Oh my gosh. So people everywhere thought that the end times had come.
Of course. Yeah. As they do.
Right.
As would I.
I would. I would be like, this is it.
Orange snow in June? You bet your ass I'm going to church.
No, you wouldn't.
No, I wouldn't. But
I would be going to my bomb shelter, though.
Yeah.
I'd be going to a fallout shelter.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Me and all my turnips would be running to someone's cellar.
Absolutely. The climate changes disrupted the Indian monsoons and caused 3 failed harvests and famine and contributed to the spread of a new strain of cholera that originated in Bengal in 1816.
Amazing.
The change in monsoons also caused flooding in the Yangtze Valley and forced thousands of Chinese to evacuate the coastal areas.
Ooh.
In the United States, a persistent dry fog was observed all over the Northeast. The fog caused sunlight to look red and dim, and the light was so dim that you could look directly at the sun and see sunspots with the naked eye.
Wow.
Right? The fog stuck around throughout the spring and summer, and neither wind nor rain could move it. So every day, same thing. Without the bright, warm sunlight we're used to, summer frost was reported in June.
Great.
In New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, and northern New York. On June 6th, snow fell in New York and Maine. On June 8th, snow in Vermont was reported to be 18 inches deep. I know. It's not like, just like, oh my God, a little bit of snow in the middle of June. Weird.
No, like,
I mean, snowstorm in the middle of June. Yeah.
Oh my God.
These amenities, continued through the rest of the summer and ruined most of the crops in North America. Canada also experienced a crazy-ass wintry summertime. Snow accumulated in Quebec City that reached about 12 inches in June. Great. Livestock also took a hit during these years, which already added to the growing list of people starving to death.
Oh, shit.
Right. So if this is what summer was like, you can only imagine winter.
Was it still around?
Yes. It was the year without a summer. But it was a whole year.
Okay.
So in the winter of 1817, temperatures in the United States were reported to be 30 below zero regularly. And it was cold enough to freeze lakes and rivers that would normally be used to transport goods and supplies.
Oh, no.
it's just not getting better.
Oh my God.
It was one of the coldest decades in recorded history, and we owe it all to Mount Tambora.
Great.
The awful weather served as a muse to many artists, however. So Mary Godwin and her stepsister Claire Claremont were objects of the town gossip when Mary had fallen in love with a local poet named Percy Shelley. And Claire had become pregnant by a man called Lord Byron. The four decided to get out of town and head south to find some nicer weather and escape the persecution from their families and communities. However, their journey was absolutely awful.
I believe that.
Their carriage was almost trapped in a snowstorm in France, and by the time they reached Geneva, the town was flooded due to rain. They wrote about their experiences and had a relatively good time sitting around and chatting and having stimulating artistic conversations with one another. Soon, however, things started to shift as they were all trapped in the same freaking house together.
Yeah.
Also, Lord Byron's personal physician was there, and he was, like, having a pass at Mary and causing, like, all bunch of drama.
Sir.
I know. While Claire had, even though she was pregnant with Byron's child, Byron was suddenly like, I don't really want anything to do with you. What? So she was, like, running around trying to get his attention and trying to seduce the man that she's already slept with.
Right.
It was a big mess.
Oh, God.
So, Byron decided to keep people from trying to murder each other, he came up with a game. He suggested that they challenge themselves to write the best ghost story. While everyone participated, Mary ended up writing one of the most iconic horror stories of all time.
Yep.
Frankenstein.
Yep.
It all comes back to Mary Shelley.
She is our godmother.
Right. We love.
We love her.
So I just thought that was really fascinating that we got Frankenstein because of Mount Tambora.
Amazing.
Ta-da!
Thank you.
Thank you. Lord Byron also wrote Darkness, an apocalyptic poem about a day that the sun decides not to rise. In another part of the country, an artist named J.M.W. Turner looked at the beautifully hazy sunsets and created one of the most well-known bodies of artwork that we have. And it's all like orange and red sunsets.
Oh. Are they pretty?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Inventions were coming out of the woodwork as well. Because of the livestock shortage, people needed another way to get around. As Lloyd Alter says in his article for treehugger.com, Baron Carl von Dreis needed a means of inspecting his tree stands that did not rely on horses. Horses and draft animals were also the victims of the year without a summer, as they could not be fed in the great numbers that they had been used to. Dreis discovered that by placing wheels in a line on a frame, one could balance through dynamic steering. Thus, a narrow vehicle capable of maneuvering on his lands became the immediate precursor to the bicycle.
How cool!
Right!
Okay!
So
it's all coming together.
I'm trying to end on like a positivist note.
Okay. Okay.
But overall, it is estimated between 71,000 and 121,000 people lost their lives in the eruption in the years that followed due to the after effects. But we may truly never know the number. And that is the story of Mount Tambora, the largest volcano eruption in recorded history.
That's awful. That was absolutely terrible.
I know.
I should put this in front of me. I'm really glad to not have lived during that time.
Me too, man. Oh my God. Can you imagine the seasonal depression?
No. Oh my God. No, I can't.
Oh Lord.
I generally don't suffer from seasonal depression until like March.
Yeah. Or yeah.
April.
February, March for me is normally like pretty...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But I can't imagine.
Thinking you're out of the woods and then it blizzards
in June.
It's more
woods.
Except now it's cold.
Right.
I can't.
Oh, God. I have two friends specifically that I think would, I don't know how they would survive. Jamie and Sarah are such little sun babies.
Yeah. Brittany.
Brittany. Oh, my God. It would be over for them.
Yeah. We have a lot of sweet summer children in the crew.
Sweet babies.
Yikes.
Yikes is right.
Well, I have yikes of a different flavor.
I can't wait to hear about it.
A different brand.
Great.
I wrote a foreword.
Oh, okay.
And I really have to stop doing these because, like, whenever I go back and like, listen, after you're done editing, before they get published, like, I find them very cringy. And what's even worse is now I'm like typing this out. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's just gross. But the point of what I'm trying to say is if you are going to board a plane in the immediate future, or if you have like major flight anxiety, this will haunt you.
Here's fuel.
Here's fuel. Fuel to the fire.
Excellent.
Let's make that flight anxiety worse.
Okay.
And listen, I get it. I almost died on Allegiant Flight 6042.
R.I.P.
I almost
R.I.P. I know you did.
Yeah.
I know.
Have I told that story?
Yes. You told it. You did tell it.
Okay, good.
I think it might have been a grab bag.
Did it? Cool of me to do that. Cool of me to do that.
Good past Jenny.
So Hans Wilhelm and Maria Kupke, a research biologist and ornithologist respectively, welcomed their newest adventure to the world on October 10th, 1954, in the form of a tiny baby girl they named Juliana, who was their only child.
Okay.
The two German immigrants made their living working in the Museum of Natural History in Lima, Peru. Juliana lived her whole life there until she was 14, when her parents left the museum to go follow another adventure, Panguana, a biological research station that was founded in 1968 and was originally only designed for a period of 5 years of field research. Accommodation originally served a wooden cabin. It stood on stilts with a roof made of palm leaves and an additional kitchen hut next to it. There's a photo on the Insta.
Okay.
Juliana spent her next few years with her parents researching, exploring, and discovering the joys and dangers of the rich landscape and what it had to offer. She learned about survival from her parents and became a jungle child. I'm not sure how Juliana feels about being referred to as that, but like multiple sources mentioned it.
Weird.
So it felt relevant to mention. Unbeknownst to the family, this immersion and knowledge of such a rugged and dangerous environment was soon going to be a matter of life and death.
Okay.
The educational authorities were none too pleased with Juliana's immersive jungle style of schooling, so she was mandated to return to the Deutsche Schule Lima Alexander von Humboldt to take her examinations. She graduated on December 23rd, 1971. Originally, Maria had wanted her daughter to return to Panguana around the 19th, but Juliana wanted to attend her graduation ceremony that she had been working towards, and so her mom agreed. And after the celebrations, they would return, and the flights were booked for Christmas Eve, aside from one, with Lineas Aereas Nacionales S.A. called Lanza.
I think I've heard of this.
Have you?
I think I have.
It's super cool.
I'm fairly certain, but I can't wait to hear more, because it's been a long time since I've heard it.
Hans Wilhelm urged his wife to avoid flying with the airline because they had a poor reputation, but they booked the flight nonetheless. And I don't want to hear anything from anyone about it if you have ever flown Allegiant or Spirit. Okay? You just don't get a say. You take your life into your own hands every single time you board one of those fucking planes.
Listen, every single time I have a client that's like, all right, I'm trying to ball on a budget. I'm like, all right, I'm going to put you on a budget airline.
Yep.
And it is It's a budget.
It's a budget.
Like, do you want to spend $500 more on airfare?
Or
do you want to have a like a nicer room at your resort?
Right.
It's pick or choose time.
Nicer room, obviously.
Right. You're only on the airplane for a short period of time, hopefully.
Hopefully. So I flew almost exclusively Allegiant for many years of my life because I was just doing direct flights from mom's house to here.
Yeah.
And then when we went to Arizona, we flew American or something. And they came by and they were like, would you like, they have free water. They give you water for free. They give you free little cookies. And they had Wi-Fi available. You had to pay for it. But like, Allegiant doesn't have Wi-Fi. You have to pay for water and snacks.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. And they gave us a free carry-on. And I was like, ooh, baby. Like, are we in first class or what?
I can't. I mean, yeah, it makes sense now that, you know, you say how many times you float Allegiant.
Yeah.
I don't ever fly Allegiant.
Oh, I've flown Allegiant probably 100 times.
I think I maybe only have flown Allegiant once.
Oh.
And I always fly American.
Oh.
It's Delta is really nice, too.
Is it?
Yeah.
I'm flying Southwest to Jamaica. So, and I've never flown Southwest, so I will see.
Hopefully they can get their shit together.
Yeah, if they, I will rain hellfire down upon Chicago Midland Airport if they cancel my flight to my own wedding.
Oh my gosh. I had a client that was traveling to Las Vegas the week that all of that shit was happening, and I was refreshing that flight every 20 minutes. I was like, don't fucking do it.
Don't you dare.
Don't do it.
Anyway, okay. So the passengers at the airport at the time were a little miffed when they finally boarded because the plane had been delayed 7 hours, especially on Christmas Eve when everyone was just trying to get home for the holidays. Finally, shortly after noon on Christmas Eve, Juliana and Maria boarded an 86-passenger Lockheed L-188A Electra turboprop bound for Pucallpa, a rough and tumble port city along the Ucayali River.
You're doing such a great job with your pronunciations.
Thank you. I'm making it up as I go.
I really struggled today.
The flight was scheduled to land a little less than an hour after takeoff. Unfortunately, the plane nor its passengers would reach that destination. Approximately 20 minutes after takeoff, the plane flew into a dark cloud and began to violently shake.
No good.
The overhead bins popped open and flowers, Christmas gifts, and luggage spilled out into the aisle.
I'm sorry, can you remind me of year?
It is 1971.
Okay.
You could still smoke on planes.
What a time.
I know. In an interview, Juliana recalled that her mother was nervous about the turbulence and said to her daughter, "Hopefully this goes all right." Juliana generally enjoyed flying and was able to stay calm. After only a few minutes, though, it became clear that their situation would not improve. From a window seat in the back row, the teenager, she was 17, watched a bolt of lightning strike the plane's right wing, which, truth be told, is a beautiful sight.
And also terrifying.
It was also, I mean, like, it's blinding, so you can't really see anything. But, like, to see a thunderstorm from an airplane is the coolest.
I'm happy for you.
So after the flash, the aircraft lost electrical power inside the cabin and could not maintain altitude. The craft was in a free fall, nosediving to the ground. Maria turned to Juliana and said evenly, "This is the end. Now it's all over." And those would be the last words she would ever hear her mother say.
Oh, heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. I spiraled a little bit when I wrote this, but when I wrote that part, I cried.
Oh,
so sad. It's so sad.
That's so horrible.
The entire interview is just like devastating. During the fall, Juliana remembers the pitch blackness and the thundering sound of the engine jets and the sound of fellow passengers screaming. She also remembers the silence that followed. The aircraft had broken apart, separating her from everyone else on board. Quote, "The next thing I knew, I was no longer inside the cabin. I was outside in the open air. I hadn't left the plane. The plane had left me." All she could hear now was the sound of wind whipping past her as she plummeted towards the solid ground.
Oh my God.
She later mentioned that the jungle canopy below her looked like broccoli. Like, yeah.
That does not do a lot for my...
I know.
My anything.
I know. It's not doing a lot for anybody anywhere.
No.
Fear wasn't the first feeling that found her. It was how alone she felt.
Oh, that's so horrible. Mm-hmm.
She could see the canopy below her creeping closer every passing second. She lost consciousness and remembers nothing of impact. And I think it's really fucking cool that our brains... do that.
Yeah.
I like Googled it.
Shut it down.
Shut it down. And I thought it was like terminal velocity that like, and your brain just like, boo doo 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 power. But
goodbye.
Bye. But that's not it. Terminal velocity is like just a speed. Your brain has like a cat-like instinct where if it sees that you're going to hit the ground at like such a distance or speed that you might survive, but with like grievous injuries, it will black you out so you survive like that trauma.
Fascinating.
Is that crazy?
The things that our brain is like, too much trauma, shut it down. Is crazy to me.
Same. I wish my brain would like shut down a little bit more.
Yeah, we could go ahead and
turn that up.
Hype that up a little.
Turn the button. Bring the beat in.
Wait for the beat drop.
Anyway, she would later learn that her plane had broken into pieces above the canopy and she fell about 10,000 feet from the sky. 2 miles. Nearly 2 miles.
Oh, Lord. Okay. That's horrible.
Yeah. She regained consciousness, still strapped into her now empty 3-seat bench from the aircraft.
And her mom was beside her, right?
No.
Like, she was beside her before there.
Yes.
The crash.
Got yes.
It. Okay.
Her first thought as she opened her eyes was, I survived a plane crash. And she called out for her mother, but the only reply she got was the insects and birds around her. Again, she became aware of how alone she was. She sustained survivable injuries, a broken collarbone, a concussion, some lacerations on her upper arm, one on her leg, and later found out that she ruptured a ligament in her knee, but she was still able to walk.
Damn.
Her field of vision had been reduced to a slit in one eye, and the other was completely swollen shut. To make her lot worse, her glasses had been ripped from her face during the fall.
Worst fear?
She was very nearsighted. It's giving me, like, very Velma and Scooby-Doo.
That is my worst, high up on the list of worst fears, is to be somewhere without my glasses or my contacts.
Really?
Yeah, I have a pair of glasses and an emergency pair of contacts in my car.
I love that for you.
If I get into a car accident or if I'm, like, somewhere and a blizzard hits and I am, like, in a ditch, I need to be able to have my glasses.
Yeah, I just am blind.
Yeah, you just trust a lot.
I just trust.
I don't.
If it's my time, it's my time.
The key difference.
I don't want to see the danger coming at me. Blissfully unaware of my surroundings.
Oh, no.
She was wearing, because she literally just left her graduation and, like, went to the airport and got on the plane.
Oh, no.
So she was wearing a white sleeveless mini dress and white open back sandals, of which she only had one left.
Oh.
She would eventually she took it with her because she would eventually use it to, like, throw it on the ground in front of her and see if there were, like, snakes or spiders or anything, like, scare them out of the way so good she idea. Could pass because she couldn't see them. She stayed in her seat because this was, like, the afternoon when she crashed. Mm-hmm. So she stayed there buckled in all the rest of the day, all the entire night. And then the next morning, Christmas Day, when she came to, she, like, came out of her brain fog a little bit. She was still in shock, but she was listening to, like, the birds and the croaks of frogs and buzzing insects. And she said, I recognized the sounds of wildlife from Panguana and realized I was in the same jungle and had survived the crash. What I experienced was not fear, but a boundless feeling of abandonment.
Oh,
and she had no way of knowing, but Panguana was only 30 miles away from her. But, like, she recognized the wildlife in the jungle.
That's insane.
Yeah. It's crazy. In shock and with only a small bag of candy that she found at the crash site to sustain her, she soldiered on through the fearsome Amazon jungle. It was in the middle of the rainy season, so there was no fruit to pick or dry kindling to make a fire and cook. More so, the days were blasted with damp furnace-level heat in the 90s, but the nights grew cold, like 50.
Ugh.
And all she had on was her white mini dress. Stingless bees swarmed her face and, like, clumped onto it, like, in the hundreds, and she had no protection from the thousands of mosquitoes who basically feasted on
her. Ate her alive.
Yes. She walked and walked using her faithful shoe to reveal any of the poisonous snakes that called that part of the jungle home, as they often camouflage themselves as dead leaves. And with her diminished vision, she was worried, but thankfully she never encountered them, or she said if she did, she never saw them.
Probably for the best.
Yes. She continued walking for 4 days and nights, rationing her bag of candy she found at the crash site. A fluttering of wings nearby drew her attention as she walked. She recognized the bird that landed nearby and was filled with dread. It was a king vulture, and from her time at the reserve, she knew that they were only drawn when there was carrion nearby. Along the creek bed, she saw what the king vulture had landed for. Three more passengers, still strapped to their bench seats, sat there, half submerged in the creek.
Oh my God.
Juliana, now Dr. Dillard, felt panic rise in the back of her throat. It was the first time she had ever seen a dead body. She picked up a stick and poked at the feet of the decedents in relief, and then immediate guilt washed over her because the toes that she saw were painted and Maria never painted her toes.
Mm.
She trudged on through the jungle. This time, she deemed it safer, not to mention easier, to walk in the creek instead of on the jungle floor.
Yeah.
The waterways in the Amazon are no small danger themselves, especially if you're barefoot. They're the heartbeat of the jungle, and they host their own perils, like 8-foot spotted caiman.
What is that?
It's a Amazon crocodile. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yikes. Stingrays who mosey along the floor will stab you with their venomous barbs when they're stepped on. Piranhas, snakes, and other terrors hide in the murky jungle waters. But still, she pressed on. She walked along the creek in her dress for days. Her bag of candy had run out and she feared starvation. Dehydration was a concern, too. The wounds on her shoulder had long since festered, as wounds do in the jungle, mm-hmm. and she feared the worst. On her 10th day in the Amazon, she was delirious, hallucinating, and near collapse when she turned a bed in the creek and saw a boat.
No way.
Convinced fever and jungle madness were soon to claim her life, she laid a hand upon the wooden side and took a huge sigh of relief when she discovered it was real. She noticed a small brush path through the jungle and followed it and soon came upon a hut with a palm-thatched roof, an outboard motor, and a jug of gasoline. Her shoulder wound, about 1 centimeter across, was fully infested with maggots.
Blech.
And she remembered a family dog with a similar affliction at Panguana. Her father had treated it with kerosene, and judging that she could do the same to herself, she sucked some of the gasoline out of the jug and poured it onto her arm. The pain was excruciating as some of the maggots tried to avoid the gas by burrowing deeper into the wound.
No.
But she was able to pull out about 30 and felt incredibly proud of herself, as she should.
What a badass.
I could not.
Oh, Lord.
She decided that the small shelter would be the best bet that she had in a while and decided to camp there overnight. When she awoke the next morning, she heard voices. She recalled that it was like hearing the voices of angels.
Aww.
Local men found her and were stunned into silence. Initially, the men thought that she was a water goddess because there's a local legend in the area that tells of a white-skinned, blonde-haired woman who was part dolphin and lived in the rivers.
Oh.
She introduced herself to them in Spanish, and they realized that, like, oh no, she's a real person, and they sprung into action. They treated her wounds, they fed her, and the next day she was airlifted to a nearby town and then to a hospital where she received medical treatment. She saw her father again the next day.
Oh my God.
He searched frantically of word regarding his wife, and on January 12th, they found her body. She survived the crash, but was too badly hurt to move, and she lived for a few days afterwards, but eventually passed.
That's horrible.
Yeah. Dr. Dillard was the sole survivor of the flight.
Wow.
And this December 23rd, 24th,
mm-hmm.
is the 50th anniversary of the deadliest lightning strike aviation disaster in history. During the intervening years, Juliana moved to Germany, earned a PhD in biology, and became an eminent zoologist.
Aww.
In 1989, she married Eric Diller, an entomologist and an authority on parasitic wasps. Cool job.
Interesting.
Despite an understandable unease about air travel, she had been continually drawn back to Panguana, the remote conservation outpost established by her parents in 1968. Quote, "The jungle caught me and saved me. It was not its fault that I landed there."
Oh.
In 1981, she's isn't that so sweet? I know. She loves the jungle.
Yeah.
Genuinely. In 1981, she spent 18 months in residence at the station while researching her graduate thesis on diurnal butterflies and her doctoral dissertation on bats.
Yeah.
Yeah, freaking
and bats.
Dr. Bats. 19 years later, after the death of her father, Dr. Diller took over as director of Panguana and primary organizer of international expeditions to the refuge. "On my lonely 11-day hike back to civilization, I made myself a promise," she said. "I vowed that if I stayed alive, I would devote my life to a meaningful cause that served nature and humanity. That cause would become Panguana, the oldest biological research station in Peru." And starting in the 1970s, right after the crash, Dr. Diller and her father lobbied the government to protect the area from clearing, hunting, and colonization. Finally, in 2011, the newly minted Ministry of Environment declared Panguana a private conservation area to help acquire adjacent plots of land. Dr. Diller enlisted sponsors from abroad, largely through the generosity of Halbfisterei, a bakery chain from Munich. And the property expanded from its original 445 acres to 4,000.
Oh, my God.
Juliana is an outstanding ambassador for how much private philanthropy can achieve, said Stefan Stolte, an executive board member of Stifterbund, a German nonprofit that promotes education, science, and innovation. Over the past half century, Panguana has been an engine of scientific discovery. To date, the flora and fauna have provided the fodder for 315 published papers, such as the biology of the new tropical orchid genus Casetum and the protrusal pheromone glands of the luring mantid.
Oh my God.
Dr. Julian Diller has an international best-selling book that she wrote of her experience titled When I Fell from the Sky, to hear about her ordeal and all the good work that she has done in her life. She is an amazing woman with an amazing story. And my sources are Survivor Still Haunted by 1971 Air Crash from CNN.com, Aldo Loop's article on NaturaPop.com, The Incredible Fall of Juliana Kupke, Sally Williams's article, Soul Survivor, The Woman Who Fell to Earth from The Telegraph, the BBC News article published on the 24th of March 2012. Titled Juliana Kupke, How I Survived a Plane Crash, and the New York Times' Franz Lids article titled She Fell Nearly 2 Miles and Walked Away.
Wow.
And that is the story of Dr. Juliana Dillard.
Holy shit.
Holy shit. She's a bad thing. She's a bad little thing.
She did it all in a mini dress.
Yes, she did.
I cannot deal with that. That's craziness. I would immediately look down and be like, uh-uh.
Mm-mm.
Not doing this in this.
No.
I don't have the right outfit.
I have nothing that I need.
I have nothing that I need.
I have literally zero skills to survive. I mean, even if you drop me off like 2 miles from my house in the wilderness, there's a slim chance I will make it.
Perish back before you get home.
Yes.
Same. I mean, she luckily knew so much about the jungle.
Yeah.
That she was able to kind of navigate and be aware of
the dangers
and maybe the things she could eat and could not.
Yes.
I know that like it was rainy season and all of that, but
I think she,
I would be the bitch that would be like, oh, look, berries.
Right. And at least she knew like through foraging.
Yeah.
Because it was the rainy season, there was nothing to eat.
Right.
Like there were no berries, no nothing. All she had was the candy without fire to cook, and she didn't have anything she could hunt with.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I don't know.
Hard times.
I don't know what I would. You'd have to eat. I think you'd have to eat bugs. You'd have to. You just have to.
I don't know if I could.
Taylor, you'd have to.
I would. Look.
You eat that giant jungle grasshopper or you die. What are you going to do?
I don't know. I might have to die. I don't think I'm going to be able to eat.
I just might have to die about it.
I would have so many tears and then I would be so mad at myself for like dehydrating myself further.
My issue would be I would eat it and a leg would get stuck in my teeth and then I'd throw up and then I'd be really mad that I wasted my liquids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't drink jungle water.
No. Sure can't.
No.
Ooh, oh my gosh. Yes. Wow. What a good one. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Do you have a bright and shiny?
My bright and shiny today is going to be my therapist, Lisa.
Love you, Lisa.
I love her to death. She's just the best. She's so chill and just helps me work through things in a way that is kind, and she knows, you know, like a good therapist knows you.
Yeah.
And I am a caretaker, but she wants me to try to reevaluate some of my caretaking techniques.
Okay.
In a way to be more productive to myself and others, which is, it's hard. That's something that is not going to come naturally to me.
Mm-mm.
So, but yeah, we're going to work on it. And
proud of you.
Yeah. So I just love the way that she handles me and my basket of crazy.
I love it. It's like she's a pro.
Yeah. It's weird. She should probably get paid for that.
Yeah, definitely.
What about you?
Just my bachelorette party. Oh. And you did such an excellent job and I felt so loved to have so many. Glad. It was like a culture clash.
Yeah.
Of like so many of like these really beautiful humans that I love in my life from very different.
Everyone had different backgrounds.
Yes.
Everyone knew you in different ways.
It was so bizarre and it was so fun and I just had a blast.
It was so fun.
I'm so thankful. to you for organizing that. You've had a lot on your plate.
It was my pleasure. It was so fun.
Love you. That's my bright and shiny. Mm-hmm. Tell us yours. Tell us if you've ever survived a plane crash by emailing us at alittlebitgrim@gmail.com. Or you can tweet it to us or DM us on Instagram.
Yeah, and you can follow us on Spotify or Apple or any of the other places that you happen to listen to podcasts.
If you liked this, you can leave us a review. It's super, super helpful.
We would love it so much. I guarantee you we'll screenshot it and send it to each other.
Yes,
and
we will.
Squeal about it.
We might post it on the Instagram. We don't know.
Yeah.
Fuck around, find out.
Yeah.
And be kind to yourself
and to others.
Goodbye.